Hi, this is Dr. Kimberly Linder, and you're listening to Incredible Life Creator Podcast. I am the author of this podcast and this book, Visualizing Happiness in Every Area of Your Life. And today, my guest is Mr. Ed Bogle. Ed Bogle is a strategic planning advisor working with and mentoring entrepreneurial companies to develop innovative solutions in market seizing strategy, implementation, brand execution, and capital sourcing. His work also includes breakthrough thinking for high growth market strategies, brand management, alliances and partnership development, mergers and acquisitions. He has developed processes to work with leadership in developing culture to drive strategies and innovation throughout the organization. He has worked with and served as a coach and mentor to two of Inc. magazine's Entrepreneur of the Year regional winners, and three of Inc. Manager Magazine's 100 fastest growing companies in the US, a former Arthur Young practice leader for the Southwest region strategic planning and management sector. His work encompassed firms ranging from startups and emerging entities to the Global 50 enterprises. He also has a passion for nonprofits and social purpose-driven entrepreneurship. Welcome to the podcast, Ed.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. Now that we've got the boring part of it out of the way, would be my resume.
Ed,
I'm
this is
sorry.
Ed from Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a misnomer. People say, you live in Oklahoma, why? Well, most people have never been here, and Tulsa is one of the most lovely cities on the planet. Its origin was the oil and gas industry, but so there's a lot of second and third generation wealth. It's a very wealthy community and therefore very benevolent. We are the home of the George Kaiser Family Foundation, which I get the privilege of working with in the nonprofit sector that you mentioned. Nonprofits is a big part of my give back, and there it's all about teaching them how to live in abundance rather than scarcity. Don't stand on the street corner with your hat out. Go for the abundance. And we've built some monsters doing that. And I love every minute of it. In fact, I probably right now I'm doing more of that than I am biz side stuff, just because it's kind of where it's gone. But the kind of non-published background part of me is really a little bit of, in my early career, I went across the stage and got my undergraduate degree. And 2 weeks later, I went down the aisle and got married. Okay. And I had a very, very beautiful life, and she changed my career forever because I went to work as a management trainee for a bank of all things. And I, because they were going to teach me how to be an investment banker. And I thought, boy, that's where the money is. That's what I want to do. It's all about the money, isn't it? And boy, was I wrong about that. I sat in meeting after meeting with these people in this bank, and, I kept going, I don't think like these people. I don't think the way they do. And I couldn't figure out if that was a curse or a blessing. So my wife said, it's a blessing. It's an absolute blessing. That creative mind of yours has a lot of places it could go. So I started speaking up and speaking out. And pretty soon the president, they got a new president out of City Corp, New York, and that president said, we've got to change everything. We need to change this bank. We need to rebrand, innovate, get ready for regional multi-bank holding company, branch banking, all of this stuff. And here comes these strange things in electronics that are coming down around our head. What do we do with all of that? And that was the challenge he laid in front of me. And I became the marketing and strategy director for that bank and was informed a couple of times by the president of that bank that I was sometimes a little outrageous in my thinking, sometimes didn't really work hard enough at dragging the team along because I had a bunch of operations people behind what we were trying to do. So anyway, I went through all of that. I got anointed and became the strategy director at a whopping age of 25 years old. And I discovered these things called ATMs. Anybody know what those are? ATMs? That's called an automated teller machine, right? Back then, they couldn't spell ATM. In 1975, we put out 12, the first remote system ever in automated tellers. There's only 40 banks in the entire United States out of 12,000 that even had one. And I thought it was a pretty cool thing. One of my guys brought it to me, a product development guy, and we took off with the thing. It became the largest and most profitable ATM system in the country. And for all I know, it may still be. And to this day, I still consult with him on that product line. Wow. Now ATMs are a commodity. Back then, they were something very novel. We quadrupled the retail size of the bank. So, and it you know, very quickly, when I got into that, and what started this journey was when the bank president came to me, he said, you know, we want you to really head up this marketing and strategy. We've got a whole lot of changes and a whole lot of challenges in front of us, and we'd like you to manage that. And without knowing exactly what he meant, I was stupid enough, says, yeah, that sounds entertaining. So, you know, I was intelligent enough to ask the question, what kind of resources and what are you specifically looking for? And he said, well, we need to rename the bank. We need to rebrand it totally. We need to really intro a bunch of new products, upgrade our current product line, and build for multi-state expansion and branching in Oklahoma. Okay, and when did you expect to have all this done? He said, why don't you take about 30 to 60 days and pull a plan together? I said, 60 days? I said, okay. I said, I don't have people. How many people do I get? He said, you tell me what you need. And lo and behold, he funded the whole thing. I turned him down twice because I wanted to be an investment banker. Mm-hmm. And he informed me on the third visit through on that. He took me to lunch at a very posh restaurant and said, you sure you don't want to take that? And I said, no, I'm pretty sure I want to be an investment banker. And he said, well, if you don't take this one, you will no longer be employed here. I said, oh, okay. It's one of those career ender things, huh? Okay. So I thought, what the heck? It's a big challenge, and build a plan. Rounded up the people. It was the people I needed. I knew where my skills stopped and where I needed some other skills. And I wanted some people that would absolutely explore the frontier that hadn't been explored at that point in time. And I wanted to make sure that I got them involved and I brought out their great energies. And we also tackled a thing that was relatively new at that time in the banks called Community Reinvestment Act. And lo and behold, on my doorstep appeared a young man named Clifton Talbert. And Cliff was, he taught me more than I ever taught him. But he went on to be film producer, writer, does things on community building. He's just excellent. And he happened to be a black man also, which in the community reinvestment world, we needed to understand minorities and redlining and how banks did ugly things with that. And it turned out great. So immediately I found out a lot about building staff. And I wanted a whole bunch of people that knew stuff I didn't know. And I wanted people that would literally get in my face and tell me where I was wrong. No foul words, be nice about it, but, you know, let's get down to the nitty gritty of what really needs to be done here. Call me out. Let's work on it together. And then let's road test all of this as we go through it. And they were pretty excited. I had two young ladies who both had master's degrees in business. They could outthink me any day of the week. Mm-hmm. And they did some wonderful, wonderful things. And in fact, both of them left me and went on to bigger and better careers. But they got their shining light kind of lit under this innovative thing we were doing. So again, it was about bringing out their great energies and taking this new electronic thing called an ATM. Because at that point in time, that's when all the businesses were moving to the suburbs. They were, you know, going where there was mixed use development, retail, commercial, you know, and residential. And, you know, we were losing people from the downtown district and we couldn't branch at that point, nor buy other banks. So we were stuck downtown. And Oklahoma had a lovely law. And don't let this taint your opinion of Oklahoma, especially northeastern Oklahoma, which is Tulsa. But they had this lovely law that you couldn't have any facility remote to your designated headquarters, unless it was connected within 1,000 feet by a tunnel. So underneath the city of Tulsa is the most fascinating set of tunnels connecting banks to their drive-ins. People don't know that. I still give tours to this day of the underground tunnels when friends come to town. Plus, there's one tunnel they swear have ghosts in it. So we do a ghost tour too. And it attracts a lot, but it made it a lot more fun. So, you know, it was really that journey. It was people things and understanding people. When we put out those ATMs, I literally had a deadline that was almost impossible to meet. The equipment wasn't that good at that point in time. It had a bunch of trouble on the electronics and the operation side, and we got all that fixed. But it took the guys internally. And I kept pushing and pushing them and pushing them. And you know what? I didn't listen to them hard enough, and I didn't understand them well. Next big project we had in electronic banking, there was nobody signing up. Okay. I learned an extremely valuable lesson about, you know, listening and understanding and, you know, getting people to work beyond the job description. That drove job descriptions, I hated. Okay. I got along well with the HR guy, primarily because his daughter was Paula Prentice, the actress. And she'd come visit. And I'll tell you what, all us red-blooded American males were very, very caught by her beauty. But anyway, the guy was, you know, he was a great listener and he wanted to change the way we did things. So, and I hated job descriptions. What I love is job roles. Job role. What's your role? And I'll come back to that a little later, because what's your role in fulfilling the vision and mission of the organization? And better yet, if you had a role in helping define that vision mission from the descriptions of your own space. And we got this, we taught the staff people, like the operations, computer people, that kind of stuff, finance, accounting, treasury, that their customer was the other people in the bank. So they took a whole different view. Some did anyway, not all. So, you know, it's just been a whole trek through all of that and building those plans and building the teams. I was only going to stay 2 years and I stayed 10. So that was kind of the end of the thing. And it's a lot of courage. You know, I finally realized about 3 days after I got that job, I didn't have a clue how to do half of that. So I had to surround myself quickly with people internally and externally that could really help push that through. Hell, just one job alone, we had 1,800 forms internally in the bank that had the hallmark and the old name on it. And I had 200 of those done and ready by the time we introduced it. President of the bank found out that was all we had done. He came reeling down to my office, slammed his fist on the desk and said, "Well, you what? That? Why don't we have all these forms redone?" I said, "Len, I had every printer in Tulsa tied up and half the printers in Oklahoma City." And I said, "Our customers were calling me to find out if I could give them some relief to get some stuff printed. Their printer wasn't available." So you learn a lot through doing that kind of stuff. And I think it's a little bit of courage. Had I really been scared, I would have said, I was just too stupid to realize that at 25, I didn't know enough to do what he just asked me to do. So what do you do immediately? You surround. So all of those out there that are supervisors and that kind of stuff, surround yourself with people, both internally and externally, that can help you get through that. What you need is the courage and the ability to build a great team. Too many people hire somebody that's not quite as smart as they are, or they think they have to understand everything about that person's job or be able to do it. Wrong. Go find somebody that's really good at what you need. And then befriend them, get the energies, meet frequently, build that great team. So what happened to me was, as I left just the journey, so you'll know where it came from, at the end of my 10 years with that bank, and we had accomplished a lot, won a bunch of awards. And incidentally, that bank now today is owned by the George Kaiser Family Foundation. And it's $58 billion, approaching $60 billion in total assets in 12 states, and is one of the top 10, not 10%, top 10 earnings banks in the country. So, and I get a lot of credit for being the one that helped build that foundation. And I immediately hand that credit off to several people in my organization. we did it as a team, and the old worn out cliche, teamwork makes the dream work. Now, teamwork makes people feel good about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. That makes them want to get up on Monday morning and go to work. And I'm not slamming down the HR world. There's a necessity, I guess, in some areas for job descriptions. But whoever got excited about their job description, it becomes a check off. I'm going to show up every day and check off. Okay, I did everything I'm supposed to do. Now I go home. Mm-hmm. That's not too rewarding or too fulfilling today. And the younger people won't stick with you. So what you need is that great team, that great things. So you want me to just keep rolling with the next question, or do you want to ask the questions? I'm sorry, I'm at the next question point.
Sure. So, So you talk about, building great teams. Like, how do you find these people? How do you know they're going to be a good fit? Not only their skills, but how are they going to be a good fit? How are they going to fit into the culture that you have?
Well, first and foremost, I'll come back to culture a little later in this, but the culture part of it is probably one of the most critical things. It's optional today to build culture, and that's what invites people in. It's mandatory at the least 5 years, at the most 10 years out, if you don't understand culture. And the big mistake everybody makes about culture is they try and build culture. Oh, here's the culture we're going to have, and here's how we're going to build it. Oh, no, that doesn't work. Culture is built, and it's led, not managed. Heavy emphasis on led, not managed. People need to participate in building that culture and finding the angles of it, and it's going to shift over time, hopefully gradually and not radically. You know, every 6 months, you got a complete culture change. There's something else wrong. So, but great cultures are what drive people to innovate, because that's part of a culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have been inside of companies, because when I left the bank, I went to work for Arthur Young, now Ernst & Young, one of the then Big Eight accounting and consulting firms. 40,000 people worldwide, a big outfit. I traveled all over the world with them, learned a whole bunch more. Incidentally, for you out there that's seeking career, keep looking for those opportunities to learn something that really will boost your value, not just another job. Oh, I've worked here 5 years and 4 years over here. No. What skills did you learn? What value lessons did you learn about culture and people and interaction? You could write a book about it if you sat down and did it. But look for those places that have that strong culture to get in and learn, so that in the future, you can be the one that leads that culture. Or God forbid, if you're crazy enough to start your own business, and a lot of people do, and I have very strong opinions about that. But if you start your own business, you better learn all those lessons. Learn them before you start the business, not after. I work with a lot of young entrepreneurs that some of them can't spell culture, okay? That's one of the first things we build now, because you're not going to get innovation unless you have the culture that supports it. You don't have innovation, you're probably dead. You just don't know when you're going to die. No business survives forever. And we have a list of them. I think right now, at the turn of the century, year 2000, I think, don't hold me to the number, it's something like 60% of the businesses that were in the Fortune 500 no longer exist.
Huge.
We had some big ones go down. Sears. Mm-hmm. Sears decided brick and mortar was the only way to go. They invented the catalog business. Did they ever do anything with it? No. They helped foster and fuel the online world, but they never bought into it. They love their brick and mortar and the diversity of their department store and all of that, which was a dying thing. Mm-hmm. And obviously, not only was dying, it died. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing about, there's a lot of things that have changed in the business world. Let me hit you with a couple of three things that are important to remember when you're dealing with what's changed about strategy and running businesses, which also tells you what kind of skills you need to be a grand employee, a great employee, if you want to be in the employment world. And employer, trust me about one thing, employers are going to get a lot smarter in sharing the wealth in the future. They have stockholders and they've got to satisfy and get a return to their stockholders. But when I work with them about their capital plans and how they build their valuation in their company, there has to be a big component of, as we make profits, as we project them, we're going to share that with the employees in a big way. Mm-hmm. Companies that have done that, especially recently in the last decade, do well because now they're fired up. So some of the key points about strategy and what's really changed on us, and that is the only constant is change. Mm-hmm. You look back in the 50s and 60s when we were building businesses, those businesses just flat, you know, they just, you know, if you could build it, there was demand and you could sell it. You didn't have to have sales and marketing. You didn't need it. Produce, produce, faster, faster, faster. Well, that gave more, that gave rise to a lot of the you know, the whole world of computers and the use of technology to improve output and production. Now look at where we are. We're starting to, I don't know if any of you out there are studying artificial intelligence, but if you're in the business world, you're a business owner, or if you're a high level or even a mid-level a manager of any kind, you better learn about AI because it's prolific right now already. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the wild frontier right now because the way they're using chat, you know, GPD, I never say it right, don't get the acronym right, but people are using that in ways that are really strange, and it's, they're not getting straight answers. It's a little bit of garbage in, garbage out still. So anyway, we've got this constant change that's in front of us. You can get a new competitor in a nanosecond. They could come overseas online and absolutely pick up, if they really understand outbound marketing in today's world. And no, it's not all just SEO, okay? SEO is still part of the concept, but it's not the concept where it was for a long time. Oh, I got to be on the first page. Well, that was true for a while. Now you've got to have the right connections. I had a client that built probably the best ever. It's a nonprofit. This is one of my nonprofit hero group. They built a nonprofit that taught kids ages 3 to 5, 6 in that range, on up to third grade, how to read. 92% success rate. Right now, today, as we speak, 2/3 of the kids in this country, the children, excuse me. I offended a lady one time. She said, I don't have any goats. And I didn't mean to offend her when I used the word kid. So I try to correct myself. But the children of today, only 1/3 of them can read at grade level by the time they reach third grade. The critical problem with that is after third grade is when the public school systems anyway stop having reading teachers.
Right.
And they don't fix it. And that's pretty scary. If you can't read, you're illiterate. If you're in poverty, you're likely to stay there. You know, it's just a whole problem unto itself that needs to be solved. And this guy invented a system. It's animated and it's a gaming type of thing, very expensive to build, but his success rate's so high. And the reason we can say that success rate's that high, UCLA did a 4-year study on this, the program. He bit his head bloody against a brick wall trying to get the public school system to adapt what he did. They said it would never work. Mm-hmm. So we went around it and went to an online environment and we discovered groups and connections. And that's what really the web's good for. We found a group called Mothers of Preschoolers mm-hmm. with 2,400 members. Do you think they were interested in what we had to offer? Yeah, big time. So we're working our way through that. But again, it's looking beyond that. So we've got that. And speaking of the web, one of the other key points about strategy and building a business, and every one of you, whether you're an employee, what do they call them at Walmart? And they're not really associates. I shouldn't insult Walmart because they're a client. They haven't been in a while, so I guess maybe I can hurt their feelings a little. But anyway, they, you know, whatever you are, look for these things inside your company. Don't go blazing pistols at somebody about you've got the greatest innovation and what to do. Ask them, ask questions. That's the way to get somebody opened up and listening to you. Have you ever thought about, would you consider something if we looked at it this way? You know, come in with a soft approach, not a hard approach. Nobody's looking for pistols firing. You got too many people out there that just can't see beyond the next week. Then they'll cut you off at the nose. So speaking of the web, The other thing we've got in today's world is we've got this clutter. And I always, when I speak, I ask people to raise their hands. How many have, with the advent of the web, have more clutter or less clutter in their life? And a lot of them put up two hands.
Right. Okay. That's what I would do, two hands.
I don't know about you guys, but it takes me about an hour and a half every day just to go through all of the emails, text messages, and other things that I get. Okay. The most worn key on my keyboard, my laptop, is the delete key. And so if you send me something and I didn't respond to it, I usually will. You may have got caught up in accelerated delete key a day. So, but that changes the whole thing. Artificial intelligence is both an opportunity and a threat, folks. In the wrong hands, that could be very ugly. Okay. And I don't need to go down in the depths of that. I'm not an expert on it. In fact, I spent 10 to 12 hours the last 2 weeks attending classes just on AI alone and how it's going to impact businesses. But one thing it's going to do is really change the need. All of this is changing your need to have clarity of your brand. What is your brand? What is your value? What's your disruption? Now, people spend an average of 3 to 7 seconds on a website. Why? Because they don't find what they want right off the bat. So boom, 3 seconds, 7 seconds, they're gone. You didn't have any time to talk to them. And you know that 30-second video or the 3-minute video or the 20-minute video that you produced? Nobody ever gets to it. They don't get to it because you haven't disrupted them. Because you've got to disrupt before you can engage them, before you can offer, before you can close. And due credit to the old branding maestro out in LA, good friend of mine, Chris Collins. That's just clarity of the brand experience. AI is going to give us a lot of ability in the areas of user interface, user experience, best known as UI, UX, among the techie world. And if you're not careful, you'll absolutely create brand slaughter. They want to get to know you. They can't walk into a store, talk to a salesperson like they used to, and get that experience, get that familiarity. They can't do that. They want to understand your brand and how it relates to them emotionally. All brands emote. And I think I spent half my career getting software developers to understand that software has emotion to it too. It was an uphill battle, but we got there. So it's, yeah. And so, you know, the whole consumer access to your and the online presence just has got, it's changed and up the value of the brand and the brand presence. Mm-hmm. You really have to cut through that clutter, disrupt, engage, offer, close. You'll hear me say that 100 times in the average speech.
So, and the other, you want to do that with your website. So they're going to look at your website for maybe 10 mm-hmm. seconds or less. So what would we put on that website to make them stay for another minute?
Well, that's dependent on each individual client. Now, that's not a consultative cop-out, but I'll give you the question to ask yourself. What is the most outrageous, if you didn't have anybody looking over your shoulders or regulatory things or any of that kind of stuff, what's the most outrageous claim you would make about your product or services?
Okay.
Write that out. Clean it up so it's not nasty and it's not illegal. And, you know, just start looking at what disrupts. You've got to disrupt before they'll even listen to you. When they landed on your page and they left it in 10 seconds or less, you didn't disrupt them. You didn't catch them. You didn't create that emotional connection in any way, shape, or form. They're not going to read the look at the rest. Of, you know, people put up these websites and too many of them, they're getting better. Say home, about us, you know, mm-hmm. yada, 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 all the way out to contact us with the assumption that somebody's going to go look at all that stuff. If your landing page, your splash page, the first thing they see doesn't disrupt them and get them go, well, that's different. We use a thing, the new website's not up yet, but we use a thing called competitive immunity. Now, people searching business go, well, what the hell's that? Mm-hmm. It's actually where you're trying to achieve an absolute competitive immunity. And I'll talk about that later if we have time. So I don't, was that helpful? Was that?
That was helpful.
Making sense. So even if you're a part of a team that's helping build the websites, get those things, you know, behind you, get those ingrained in you and that kind of stuff. Because you can spend, if you have hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars to spend, yeah, you can get your brand out there. But most early stage smaller businesses don't. And usually you're very targeted. And if you're not targeted, I want you to call me up and we're going to have a conversation. Because if you're not targeted, you have a tendency to waste a lot of advertising dollars. That was the problem with the advent of television, radio, outdoor boards, newspapers. That went to so many people in so many different demographics, you didn't know who you were really reaching. And so there's an old adage years ago in the advertising business. I know half my advertising dollars are wasted. I just don't know which half it is. Uh-huh. So tell that to your CEO sometimes. That really irritates them. We're wasting half our dollars and we can't figure out what it is. So that's you know, so the context, it just paints a much better need for innovation and that consistent innovation. And when I talk about innovation, I'm talking about innovate what people need in the future, not just a little tweak to your product or your service. Spend time, you know, and we break it into four quadrants, and I've got a quadrant matrix analysis that people can do. And maybe we can share that stuff with some people at some point and be happy to, you know, I got a more likely chance that you'll call me and say, hey, can you help me with this? If I give you this stuff and you try and journey down, because it's a matter of building priorities too. You can't do things on an overnight basis. And the first thing you do is you look at that quadrant that deals with my existing customers. What do I do to improve my franchise with them? What do I do to up the value of me? Because, you know, running a business is about creating value for a specific set of customers and then migrating that value over time. And I can't tell you, I've spoken literally all over the world, most of it domestic U.S., but I got to go to Cali, Colombia. I spoke in India, spoke in Indonesia, some other places. It's always fun to be a speaker and have a translator hanging off your shoulder or in a little soundproof booth and they're translating everything you're saying and you have no idea where they are. You learn how to pause every once in a while. Don't talk fast forever. So, the you know, innovation, culture, clarity of your brand, the brand experience, you know, that disrupt, engage, offer, close. And if you're in a referral model, this is how I wake people up in the middle of a speech. Let's talk about the nude model. N-U-D-E, nude. Everybody pays attention when I say that, okay? Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. And it was actually invented by a friend of mine. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. His name's Scott DeGraffenried. He used to live here in Tulsa, and he's in Dallas, was in Dallas. But anyway, it stands for, people don't refer. Everybody wants to say, well, I'll pay you to refer. People will not refer unless you meet the nude model. Novelty, it's different, clearly different, clearly different outcomes using the product or service. Utility, it works easily and that kind of stuff. You know, it's not hard to use. I can use it. It makes sense. Dependability, it works every time. It doesn't work 30% of, you know, 70% of the time, the other 30, good luck. And that's, pointing that out to software people was a lot of fun. Okay, so you've got that novelty, utility, dependability, and the last is economics. Is the value-price relationship good? Mm-hmm. Too many entrepreneurs and businesses make the mistake, well, we'll just keep the price low. Well, if you're up against another and you're trying to penetrate that market, there is some penetration pricing strategies. But most of the time, if you've got the highest value, you probably also have a higher cost basis, and therefore, you know, you need to charge a higher price to make a good profit. So part of what you need to do is make sure that that value proposition is clear in relationship to the economics. It's not that hard to do. In fact, when I teach sales training, I teach the salesman, guys, if you had the lowest cost product with the highest value in the marketplace, we wouldn't need salesmen. So let's get over that right now and move on to talking about how you really effectively sell. And incidentally, the answer to that question, selling is not selling. Selling is finding the people that have the highest demand and the least amount of barriers to get to. That's what great salespeople do. They go out and find somebody that already has the need. So anyway, what this is doing to us is changing. You want me to go on, Kimberly? Yeah, I don't.
You're doing great.
I don't know. Sometimes I get to rambling. I've taught at the collegiate level several years, and I start sounding like a professor. It's time for me to sit down. So, anyway, so what the big thing that changes is there's a whole new leadership role in driving innovation and brand development. And the big thing that takes is an engaged staff. You know, we've all been to those restaurants or a favorite store or shopping mall or whatever, where the people are engaged and you can tell they're happy. They're happy to be there. You know, and the importance of that is if the staff is engaged, they know their role. And in fact, a little side note, I have the people write their roles. If I'm doing, okay, we need to revamp our customer service, I have the customer service people write it. They do a much better job than anybody in a line function or staff function like HR or whatnot. They can guide them and give them some principles, but the people will do a marvelous job. In fact, you have to kind of rack them back a little bit. They'll give away the farm trying to make everybody happy. So you need to do that. So it's really important that you identify your markets big time. Who are my target segments? You can have five of them if you got the money to chase five of them, but concentrate on doing one really, really well and building off of that. Because once you become a trusted brand, you can poke a whole lot of products at them. And until you prove that it doesn't meet the nude model, they're going to keep buying. They're going to keep referring. That's what you want in your business. So people need that emotional connection to your brand. All brands emote. Remember that. So what is our emotional connection and how do we reinforce that? What is every touch point in our business? That's all part of the brand. How many of us have been to great experience online with something and then got to their customer service department and thought, holy crap, I can't even talk to these people. You know, that's called brand slaughter. My good friend, David Corbin, wrote a book on brand slaughter. In fact, that's the title of it. That's a great book about branding. Take time to pick it up. The other one I mentioned a couple of times, you're building your organization, this little book, can you see it?
Put it up a little higher.
Huh?
Put it up a little higher so we can see the, okay, how to create, okay, thank God it's Monday.
Yeah, this is my good friend, Roxanne Emmerich. She wrote a book upon, thank God it's Monday. And the subtitle to it, which you probably can't read, is how to create a workplace you and your customers love. Now, if you can get to the point where you and your customers love it, then that's great. I'll send you a picture of the cover of the book. Anyway, she just does a marvelous job, and she's done most of her work in the banking industry, an industry that was notorious for really, as I used to call it, suck brick service. They just were horrible. You know, it was all about the numbers. And, you know, the first thing we changed in there, we looked at what was rewarded and punished. Well, everything in a bank is negative. How many overdrafts? How many bad loans? How many hot checks did you take? You know, they're so nervous. You know, how many frauds did you have in, you know, your online stuff? Your wire transfers was a big area of fraud about a decade ago. And, you know, so they pulled all these rules in place that turns the customer service into a pile of ashes. And yet you've got to work your way around that. So, and too many people declare a strategic position, but they don't have the competencies underneath it to support it. So we like to build competencies. And I have templates and stuff on that as to how you do that. So those competencies support the strategy, and that's what gives you the Excel. Easy example of that just is Walmart, because everybody knows Walmart. If you don't, you're living under a rock somewhere, okay? And Walmart, oddly enough, you know, they're up to, I think, 11,000 stores, the world's largest retailer. And, you know, what they excel at is what? One simple thing. What's their claim, their grand strategy, their competitive difference and immunity? It's price. And it has been proven historically over most long periods of time, Walmart does have the lowest prices on most things, not all, but most. And how do they do that? And how do they maintain that? Underneath them, they have the world's largest distribution system. They have 12 or 13, 14, I don't know what they've got, in the United States, warehouses that could house 5 football fields inside of them. And the joke inside the company is that we can run those with 5 people. Okay.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It's all automated, and they know the supplies, you know, the stores are coming out. And I worked with their architectural firm that did all their Walmarts. Nothing too exciting about a cinder block building, but being able to create the movement and the product layouts and that kind of stuff. And these guys literally, they called it trees to keys. You point to where you want the business located, and 6 months from now or less, I'll hand you the keys. And it took Walmart internal group over a year to do that. So they've taken all of that external. And so, but that was all part of it. Southwest Airlines lately has been a problem. So I shouldn't maybe venture there. But Southwest Airlines, up until recently, was the world's most profitable airline. Why? Because they, you know, and their whole thing was about happiness and fun loving and that kind of stuff. I think the brand is tarnished right now. Because I had a friend that was coming back from Florida and I was to pick up at the airport. 2 days later, I got to pick her up. So, and it was all internal problems inside predominantly. Anyway, it appeared to be internal problems to Southwest. That's unusual for them. I did work with them years ago, and I don't admit to this often, but we built the original 1 through 30, 30 through 60, or 31 through 60 plastic boarding pass. You never wanted to admit to that while you were in line at the airport, okay? You could get run out of town on a rail or hung by a rope right there in the lobby. That was not a popular part of it. That's why a lot of it changed later. But again, it's those underlying things. And Southwest flies all 737. Now, they range from, I think they got most of the 200s out, but they range all the way up into the Dreamliners. So they fly the same airplane. Well, training, spares and parts, you know, the time to repair, all of that is much faster doing it that way. And that's what led to a better. So you got to look at those underlying competencies and capabilities. And the culture and innovation thing, too. One more note about that. I like to call it riding for the brand. You know, when you've walked into a company and everybody rides for the brand. That great restaurant where they're just in sync. If you only saw the battles that went on in the back room between the kitchen and the front staff, you'd think they hated each other, but they figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I worked with one of the largest restaurants in Houston, and they had a beautiful thing. And they called me, it was early 2020, about mid-April. They said, "What the hell we do? The pandemic's shutting us down." And I said, "You're going to have to look, you know, and what you're going to do in the future." I said, first and foremost, up your catering business, because people will still want catering. Mm-hmm. And I said, two, to get your people back, you're going to have to change the way you treat them. And they all have a guaranteed salary now. And it's, I won't let any secrets out of the bag, but it's close to $25 to $30 an hour, plus vacation time, plus bonuses of the profitability of the restaurant. Bonuses against the customer survey, satisfaction surveys, and we completely retrained them. They're not called waitresses anymore in that restaurant. I'm your culinary tour guide.
Oh.
Because it's a South African fusion restaurant, and who in the hell knows what South African fusion is? There's 32 indigenous countries in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So they got Afrikaner, they got the Portuguese, they've got the, you know, all these different cuisines. It's the best place I've ever eaten in my life. If you're ever in Houston, Texas, look up Pele Pele. Although I'm making no promises, the restaurant just sold about 6 months ago. The three owners couldn't agree on which way the sun came up. And it wasn't east versus west. It was east versus west, maybe south. You know, they just couldn't see the same thing on the same page. And we worked our way through a lot of that. So anyway, in a note about innovation, okay? Innovation is it's so critical today. It wasn't all that important. You could ride a brand for 20, 30, 40 years. They don't last that long anymore. We're in an era of compression. Brands don't last as long. People don't stay with you as long. You know, I had a client of mine say, "I hate invested training people because they don't stay." And I said, "Well, let's talk about that." We came up with some solutions. I won't go into them today, but it had to do with pay and compensation and input to the system. I will tell you, when we build a strategy, we get inputs from all nooks and crannies. Everybody has the opportunity to give their input on their area and what they think about the company's general vision, mission, you know, purposes, their real culture. We get input from everybody in the entire, or they have the opportunity. Not everybody responds. Some people are, yeah, I really am here. This is my third job out of, you know, my three. And I just want to get my paycheck every week. You know, there are those people that aren't interested in moving it forward, but most people aren't. They want to feel that growth. They really do want to get up on Monday and say, thank God it's Monday. I get to go to work. And I don't know about you. That's hard to come by in a lot of places, but you can build it. You can do it. So we do a lot of things about, I call it the innovation mandate. You don't have a choice to innovate if you want to stay around for a while. If you want sustainable, profitable, long-term growth, you better innovate. And innovate, again, is innovating what they need in the future. A little tweak off of your product might buy you a little bit, but not much. And so you've got to keep a rolling dialogue of what, where are we going to be in 3 to 5 years? What do we see? And then what do we keep updating that? We have a tool called a three-phase growth plan where you break your company into three phases and say, well, okay, you know, what's phase one? And phase one's usually the next 12 to 18 months. What are our targets? What do we got to hit, including financials? Now, I don't mean to offend anybody in financial, but running a business is more about building value for your customer. The higher the value, the better the margins, ergo, the better the profits. Now, don't get me wrong. Profits are like breathing. Without them, you cease to exist, okay? You're fine if you don't make money. So we can't go off the wild end. But if we start getting into a phased growth plan where it goes out 5 to 7 years and it's a rolling horizon and we keep updating and changing that, most of my clients do it on a quarterly basis. Do that. If your company's not doing that, suggest they do it. You know, get involved in how they could do that. And maybe we can share some of this stuff with you. So let's just summarize by saying that, you know, the conditions under business operate today is not the same, going to be the same 3 years from now. Okay. I ask people that question right in behind the other one, and they'll say, you know, the clutter question. And I'll say, how many of you believe your business will operate under the conditions operating today 3 years from now? Nobody ever raises their hand anymore. Mm-hmm. One guy did one time, but he was in the, they were manufacturers of military equipment. And they had a pretty steady gig that things weren't changing on them that much. Now, I bet they wouldn't say that. So we want to, you know, so when we get into all of that, you know, we've got to migrate all of this, and we migrate the brand. We do a thing called a brand map, which has the brand emotion, the brand value in it. In other words, how do we do that? And you migrate each one of those little pieces every time. And if you get the people that have to execute it involved in the development of the strategy, I don't know why, but that seems to work better than 5 or 6 people sitting in an ivory tower coming up with what the plan's going to look like. So share.
So when you're talking about your plan and you're thinking like 3 to 5 years ahead and you're thinking, what are my customers going to want? What are my customers going to need? Uh-huh. Are you watching the markets? Are you watching the trends? How are you creating that to figure that out ahead of time?
If you're not talking to your customers, you will be out of business shortly. Okay. Your customers will tell you what they want, what they think, and that kind of stuff. I had a client 4 or 5 years ago. Called me up desperate sounding, wasn't even breathing good. And his problem was they had one client that accounted for 65% of the revenues. That client had just come to his office and announced that they were leaving. And he was gasping for air because he wouldn't be able to even make payroll at the current levels. So I said, come on. I said, shame on you guys. If you've got one customer, 65% of your revenues, and you're not talking to them, that's pretty dicey. You should know where they're going next and how you're going to support them. So it's a little bit about getting ahead of the game, but a lot of that is too taking your employees. This whole thing about the ATMs and doing that with the banks in the 70s, That was my pipe smoking product development guy sitting over in the corner back when you still could smoke in an oven. And he smoked a pipe and he pulled the pipe out of his mouth and let a little bit puff of smoke into the air. And later, incidentally, the lady started complaining about it. So I told him, I said, you don't have any choice. You're not smoking that thing in the conference room anymore. But anyway, he pulled the pipe away from his mouth and he says, I think these ATMs could solve a problem. Okay. It wasn't my domain. It wasn't the executive management group's domain. It was our department and the people inside the bank, knowing the customers and staying in touch with them. We did an awful lot of customer surveying back then. Now it's hard to do, but I still use focus groups a lot to get the feel for what people are thinking and what they think about what they need in the future. You can throw examples out there. You got to be careful not to bias it so they'll get their answers. That answer your question?
Yes,
it did. Or was I the successful consultant and avoided the answer?
No, great. Thank you.
You bet. So, pause here for a second. There's a concluding thing I was going to do. Is that okay?
Yes, please.
We're about up to a full hour. I could go for another 2.5 hours if you hadn't noticed. So.
I mean, know.
Well, what happens
so much
to
information
me,
and so much experience, and it's valuable. And thank you for sharing.
Well, do you think it's going to make a good podcast?
I think it is.
You have to go back and listen to it. It's kind of like, you know, any speaker being online or in present, you have to make a decision. Are you going to take your years of experience and just make 1 or 2 points? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to, you know, let them drink from a fire hydrant? You just drank from a fire hydrant.
Yep, we sure did.
And I apologize for that, but if you picked off 1 or 2 important things for you, I've done my job, okay? And you can't take 40 plus years of doing this and capsulize it even in an hour very well. I do better at it sometimes than others. I didn't do that, but let me do this close piece and then we can add any cleanup you want to that. So people ask me, well, what are the most critical things to do when you're putting a business together or you're working for a business? What should you do to help that business get better? So number one, strategy and running a company is about a focus on value creation for target segments. It is not a focus on profits alone. Too many, after they do the strategy, what do they look back on every month, every quarter, annually? The budget. How do we do with the numbers? And then everybody just starts throwing darts at what we, you know, did and what we needed to change. And too often they change before they've really had a chance to succeed. So it's a focus on value creation for the set customers. Great value, profits will follow. And in fact, a lot of times the person that isn't really in tune with what I'm doing is the chief financial officer, because they're used to running that annual budget. And that's what they call their strategy. Those are just numbers you got to execute. So, because the higher the value, the greater the margins. Driving up value over time and cost down, that's when you own the market. Mm-hmm. If your value is so high, nobody can really penetrate you. They may pick off this over here and over there. But then you've driven your costs down. It's pretty hard for anybody to come and compete with you on the basic cost. So you start building that defensive shield, that competitive immunity over time. Second one, the key to value creation is target segments. I had a client once who said, I asked him, I said, who's your target market? And he went, El Mundo. And for those of you that don't speak Spanish, and I don't either, I just know what that one means. El Mundo is the world. Mm-hmm. And you know what I asked him? I said, I got one salesperson sitting out in the lobby. Where do I send him first and why? I forced him to start segmenting because he was too scattered over too many markets. Mm-hmm. And it damn near ruined him. There was a lot of other things that damn near ruined him. So the third point in there is growth and survival is about innovation. It's the change in that value over time. That creates that monster called competitive immunity. Mm-hmm. I dare anybody to take Walmart on the basis of price. Target tried it and failed. Mm-hmm. So what did Target do? They rebranded and went innovation. So it's got to be not slightly better, but innovate what they need in the future and talk to them about it. Talk to the people that sell products. If you've got salespeople and that kind of stuff, interview your customers, get some feedback. Number four, and this is really important now, none of that works without an engaged team, culture, and leadership. Unfortunately, a lot of the business schools, including the entrepreneurial schools, teach too much management and not enough leadership. Most of your strategy was born out of the old, you know, warlords of the day. Napoleon, Maximus of War, Tun Tzu on the Art of War. There was a book written called The Critical Analysis of the Vietnam War and why it failed. One of the big tenets in there was nobody knew what the mission was. So they got up every day, smoked some dope, you know, and didn't have targets, didn't have, you know, we like objectives. We're going to take Mount Suribachi by next Tuesday. Okay. Now, to take it by next Tuesday, what do I have to have? Well, I got to have tanks. I got to have military on. I need the meals. I need everything to be able to take that. Mm-hmm. So that's important. But if you've got the engaged team, you know what's crazy about an engaged team? Then if you want to shift and change things, they're ahead of you. They're ready to go. Let's engage. Let's move. Mm-hmm. People really don't mind change as long as they can participate in it. It's when it's just thrown at them like a hardball, hits them right in the forehead between the eyes, it's tough for them to get along. So those four things are the critical things you got to do to really, really run a company or a department or a division. And if you're working inside of one of these companies, look for those things about value creation. Look for those things about culture. Look for the targets. Who are you really segmenting? How do we do with, you know, on our customer service? And I will tell you one of the secrets that I absolutely still use to this day. I had the people that have to implement it, write it with guidance, with some objectives, but they damn sure do a better job than bringing in somebody from outside that doesn't know your customers, doesn't know your culture, because it's usually a multiple complicated thing. But it's so much fun. It's so engaging. That's what my passion in life is. These are like gigantic jigsaw puzzles, and they're hard to figure out, and they're tough. But we broke it down into pieces. We use some templates. We use 3 to 7, 8-year, 10-year horizons and break it down into manageable little pieces, and then we continually upgrade it. We continually have the people involved. And guess what? If they're involved in this strategy and its development, they'll execute it. We use this thing called a one-page framework. It's called the Focus Strategic Framework. I've actually seen people go, that box right there on that framework, that's my box. That's me. And I'm going, I don't know how that.
Yeah.
But the execution, the change, the shifts comes from within a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to do your external marketing. You got to be smart. And you really, really, and I didn't get into it today, but you really have to manage your capital. That's I didn't think it was a great topic for us to hit today, but if anybody wants it. And maybe later in the future or something, we can break these down into pieces and maybe drill down a little bit more on those of interest. Mm-hmm. The culture thing's really fascinating. And it's fun because it takes advantages of people with differences of personality. You know, I know we've all been through the DISC models and the Myers-Briggs and all those things that told me about my personality. I already knew it was broken. They didn't need to tell me that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I've never seen anybody succeed in putting that all together and how you utilize it internally. There's been some people who have made good runs at it, but I don't know. There's some new models coming out that really look pretty fantastic. And they've got an artificial edge to them, so that gets scary. So anyway, I hope everybody enjoyed that. Ask questions. I don't know if you're planning on doing it, Kimberly, but if they want to write in and ask questions, we'll gather them and try and answer them. I don't know if that's beyond the scope of what you want to do. So,
right. Well, actually, I would like for you to just share with people how they can connect with you. And I think you were saying you wanted to give people some resources too. And So maybe
yeah, templates and that. Information. Yeah. I'm more than happy to send you some templates if I hit any specific, you'll love this slide. It says, let me know how I may help you. Private email, ebogelcoxnet. They can reach me there. They can text me on my cell phone number.
Okay.
And the whole purpose of...
Wait, you got to say it a little slower so people can get it. Ebogel@cox.net.
Okay. That's my private email, so don't abuse it. It won't be my private email anymore.
Uh-huh.
My cell, that's my cell number. You can text me.
Okay.
Now, I travel a lot. I might not get back to you in 24 hours. It may be 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be any longer than that, I'll send you a text or an email back saying, hey, I'm, in Cali, Colombia, where infamously there's a picture of me taking salsa dancing lessons from a professional.
Wonderful. Sounds like
And it only proved that I don't dance well. And the picture that's on there says, if I look like this, pay attention, you're not getting it. So I can be a consultant and very good one, I think. And I can also be an insultant if I need to be. But I approach it subtly before.
Mm-hmm.
I take a blame, and this comes from teaching. I take a lot of blame for not, if people don't get what you're talking about, is that your fault or the student's fault, the listener's fault? I blame myself. When I taught at the collegiate level, if 90% of the class didn't get the answer to a question, then I didn't explain the question very well or teach it very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually threw it out of the exam. Everybody did good in my classes because I'd throw stuff out because of my ineptitude. That's a scary picture. So you can't see it, can you? Or can you?
No, I can't see the picture.
You would have had to share my screen.
Yeah, okay. So, but anyways, let me just ask you a personal question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What gives you the most happiness and fulfillment in your life at this point?
Woo. Well, number one is sleep. But
never got that answer, but that's a great answer.
I just can't get enough of that. It's kind of a fairly even split depending on what my workload is, but I get an awfully big charge out of my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Watching them grow. They're now to the point they're asking me questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of fun to be able to visit with them about that. I was just with my two of my grandsons up in Kansas City over the last weekend. And that gives me a lot of joy and that kind of stuff. But I'm here to tell you, some of the success we've had, a lot of the success we've had, that's so joyous. And it's never me alone. It's always a team. I don't tell them what to do. I'm not the consultant that parachutes in, examines your company for 2-3 weeks or whatever, and then tells you what to do. You know, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we develop a process called CORE. We use it primarily where we've got to, a company's in trouble and we've got to rebuild it. And CORE, basically, we spend about 3 months in medium-sized corporation. We did a lot in the healthcare industry when they were going through a lot of change. And everybody looked at their budgets, looked at their plans, looked at their strategies. And then we had a way of bringing that all together through CORE process. I won't ever tell anybody, but the original name of that, because it was an Arthur Young product, was Competitive Opportunity Resource Evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that isn't a buzzy consultative term, I'm bleh. I told him, I said, I'm not telling anybody that name. So
you just made it simple and people can remember.
Yeah. No, the joy of my life really is in part the work and in part the family.
Mm-hmm.
I probably put a little too much emphasis on, I gave up, let me back up. I gave up work opportunity. Okay. To make sure that personal life, because those are your deep joys.
Mm-hmm.
And made sure that personal life worked. You know, I was very fortunate and had a very wonderful life, which, I lost a few years ago. And it, you know, that's really ripped me up. It really has. And but the joy of being with my family and whatnot, they're crazier than I am. And I probably had a level of responsibility with some of that. My wife kept them down the straight and narrow, but a lot of that joy of family and watching your children grow, the joy of watching a business grow and watching the people with the happiness, watching them be able, because the other downside or the upside, which I didn't mention, when your company starts sliding downhill, it's a hell of a lot easier with an engaged staff to find the cures and move forward and actually leapfrog. CORE is a downsizing methodology, but the first thing we did is I led the senior execs and the key managers on a journey through what do we think our future is after all this gets behind us? And they dug in, they loved it, they built a plan, we embellished upon it, and they executed that plan. And it was a healthcare company. We had hospitals and clinics and home health and the whole nine yards. And guess what? They were number four or five in the region. They're now numero uno.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's
You
pretty
just have to
awesome
do it.
to it's the rewards of watching the people blossom in that environment. It's watching them get excited. And it's really fun. I did so little work in Tulsa, but I'll used to be I'd be at a convention or something or speaking and I'd run into these people and oh my God, Ed, yeah, let me tell you where we are now, you know. And I get emails and text messages. That's a great reward. It's not the financial reward. Yeah, I made a decent living at it. Did I get rich? No, you don't do anything by the hour and get rich off of it. Okay. You've got to build some, assets and that kind of stuff. Build something to sell is what I like to say. Always build your company to sell. And I guess some of this could be considered intellectual property and I could sell it, but I don't know how in hell I'd do it. No. It has been a joyous ride. I felt good about what I was saying. I got just disjointed on the sequence.
I
And I
think you're
think
doing a great job, and you just gave so much information. You gave so much information. You almost gave a whole college semester in this 1 hour.
I
So
gave you
many
about three fourths
nuggets.
of what I planned on saying. So
Well, that is beautiful.
well, but. What I like to do, and Bernie allowed me to do it, like I teach a broad class like this. And usually those were, when Bernie called them super teaching, I think, when they had the three screens in the room and all of that. He would then let me do breakout classes, either that same week or in subsequent CEO space events. And that held pretty true. And it was, that's where I said, okay, you heard me talk about building culture. Here's the class on culture. That may have not have been Bernie. That may have been CEO Space Clubs, could have been. I spoke at so many different places. I never remember what presentation I gave when. And if you, I bet you would agree with this. I've never given the same presentation twice.
I bet you haven't. I bet
Now,
you have. So, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and for sharing
you
all
are very
that.
welcome. I'm excited about what you're doing
Thank
because it's
you.
that passion and energy and the, love for what you do that changes your life.
Yeah, so
Work shouldn't be
I have
work.
one last question for you, actually.
Uh-oh.
My last question of the podcast. What is your best advice on living an incredible, amazing life?
Well, I don't think I've ever been asked that. Is probably it's don't start out with the reward at the end in mind, be it monetary or anything else. Just dig in and go and work and let it happen and find ways to overcome the barriers, get your people huddled up and watch it happen. That's the greatest reward. When we started out down that path of redoing that whole bank, I had no freaking idea what we were going to do, but I knew I had some smart people. And the president of the bank was crazy enough to turn trust a 25-year-old with half of the previous year's earnings. So I had a good budget. So it's just the pure joy of working with people. I used to start every project with what's the end in mind? Well, yeah, you got to have some end in mind. I needed to change the name of the bank, rebrand it, put out certain products, that kind of stuff, and I had to do it in this time period. I knew that, but I had no idea what that was really going to look like, how we were going to promote it, how we were going to manage it internally. And we needed everybody huddled up together to get that done. Had that staff not been engaged, it would have fallen flat on its face. And a lot of companies do that. They have a new product introduction and then they fall. So, and it's, I don't know where you get any more joy than that. It's kind of like raising your children. I'm old enough now that I feel like I'm raising my grandchildren. I deal with some of these young folks. I've got a client that's a CEO. He's 28 years old. He at 28 is a lot smarter than I ever thought about being. So it's that's just pure joy. And you know, at the end of the day, an engaged team, a company that's active with developing their strategy and renewing it and building competitive immunity, the financial rewards will be there. You don't start out with the budget and the financial projections, and you know, that's certainly a part of what you want to try and hit. But I guarantee you, it's going to be a rocky road. I don't care where you go. And boy, having those good people around you and fun and being able to laugh, even though it's 9 o'clock at night and you've been there since 7:30 that morning, you're still, those people become lifelong friends too. So it helps develop friendships and whatnot. That's the joy. That was a long answer to a very short question, and you probably wanted a shorter answer, but I hadn't thought about it before.
Right. Well, that was a
So
wonderful.
you got me processing, is what you did. If I start talking a lot, that's usually because I don't know the answer and I'm processing out loud.
Well, you did a wonderful job, and thank you for that answer. And people in our relationships, whether they're at work or in, family, that is the most important thing, I think.
Yeah. And emphasize to your listeners, because I totally believe in what you're doing and the spirit behind it. And, you know, if they've got specific questions, I mean, they can call me, they can text me, they can email me. I'll try and get specific information to you. I've written a lot of white papers I've published before. I don't like either one of the books I wrote, even though people like them. I never tried to promote them or sell them. You know how that is. That's a tough proposition. But if they want to know more, have them get in touch with me. I do have a limit of how much I'm going to talk to them for free, because this is how I make a living. So,
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ed.
you are welcome. Thank you for letting me come on.
Yep, we'll talk to you again soon.
If you need any more for any reason, let me know.